All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back, everybody. Taxation is theft. Welcome to the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off. Broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico. I'm Dan Taxationist Theft Berman, former candidate for President of the United States, where I ran from a hammock down here in Mexico, and currently running for Governor of Texas from that very same hammock. I'm required by law to tell you that you should not listen to the show if you suffer from PTSD, anxiety, depression, or have suicidal thoughts. And today I've got a very special guest with me, John Merryfield, who is the president of the Institute for Objective Policy Assessment. He is a retired professor of 32 years from a professor of economics from UT San Antonio. So before we get started, I just want to ask again, I know you guys are amazing and supporting, you've been amazing in supporting my campaigns and the podcast, but I want to go ahead and ask you to continue to give me your support so we can continue putting on this show and all of the other shenanigans that we do to, I want to say take down the government, but that sounds so criminal. All of the things that we do to make people realize that taxation is theft, not just here, but around the world. You can do that by visiting taxationistheft.cards or taxationistheft.info and buying one of these awesome hats, a flag, a t-shirt. Anything you buy from us helps to support the cause. You can also make donations at danforfreedom.com, which is the new campaign website. So without further ado, on to the show. John, welcome. How's it going?
It's going really well. You know, I'm toying with the idea of running for a state representative seat just to get this message out a little better. And by this message, I don't mean just school system reform, but a bunch of messages that my institute is pursuing by spending today doing a climate change audit. Part of it. It's not something you get done in a day.
Right.
That's part of what the institute is about, is to rake the truth out of all the competing claims on the climate change issue.
Right. That sounds really interesting, actually, and I want to get into that. But we've been emailing back and forth talking about something that's apparently really popular right now. I hear that the Republicans are all over this. School reform and what that looks like. And now you are a retired professor. So let's talk about that first. How do you get into that profession? What was interesting? Was it just that you had, you were in love with economics and you decided you wanted to profess it? What really got you into there?
Well, the school system reform part happened at the back end of that. And by the way, you said school reform. The first chapter in the book is about the difference between school reform and school system reform. Now, but let me return back to your question. I didn't like economics at all at first. I was through my master's degree before I even took a liking to it. I had a master's degree in geography. I was all about the environment and maps. And then I discovered that if I was going to make much sense out of things, I had to figure out how people deal with scarcity, because that drives nearly all decision making. So at the PhD level, I decided to get a degree in economics, in particular environmental economics. And that's one of the things that I still do. But sort of 15 years into the 32 that I spent at UT San Antonio, I discovered some writings on the school system issue, which were just basically utter drivel, and much of it still is, because it suffers from what our population suffers from, namely economic illiteracy. So I decided that there was so much wrong, misleading, and irrelevant stuff being said about the most important thing that we have to do to keep our country alive, namely educate our children, that I had to jump in on that. So I haven't totally left my environmental economics and other things behind, but I spend most of my time now on the school system reform issue and why it's not working, which is basically, it's just another example of a central planning failure. So if we're gonna solve the issue, we need to have a substantial sector of our school systems, which I define to be public and private combined, everything that goes on to educate our children. We have to have a substantial piece of that governed by the process that makes all successful industries successful, namely the process of entrepreneurship and consumer choice orchestrated by price formation and price change. Again, to distill that down, that's how all of our functional industries operate. Somebody proposes something that they think people will buy, and people either buy it or don't. And then the price system, prices going up and down, makes sure we don't run out of things and provides incentives to entrepreneurs as to what to produce and how to produce it,
right,
and where to produce it.
And it's interesting because it's not just, I mean, we usually talk about economics and supply and demand as a function of business, entrepreneurs, industries, and all this other stuff. But in reality, this is all true of everything, things that have nothing to do with money. Who you true. Decide to spend your time with, your friends, your family. Do I enjoy spending my time here, or do I enjoy spending my time here better with somebody else? Like it plays, it's almost like it's a very basic human instinct that controls our decisions. And it's just that money happens to be an extremely popular topic where that really comes into play.
Right. Economics is about way more than money. And the reason that socialism fails, which is what our school system does, it decides things through the process that drives socialism, namely bureaucracies and experts trying to figure out how to do things. And it always fails. And Calvin Coolidge, one of our greatest presidents, nailed it. He said it will fail because it's against human nature. So no matter how right. rosy and fine and squishy and cool it sounds, sadly to many of our young people, it just never works. And it usually fails terribly. Sometimes we're lucky enough we could just vote it out of existence. But most of the time it takes a revolution to throw it off of our backs, to get rid of it once it's installed, because the people who we give power to don't like to give it back.
Right. And it's really interesting too, because like what I like to talk about a lot is how, you know, the people who want socialism aren't necessarily bad people. It's, you know, they have legitimate concerns. They have needs that need to be filled. But it's politicians who are usually coming around and telling them, oh yeah, this is socialism. That's how you're going to get what you want. Let us steal from everybody and then we'll have enough to give you, you know, 5% of that to get you what you want. And it's all part of a scam. But of course, to somebody who's usually an advocate of socialism, it's not because they're, you know, focused on how it works. They're focused on why they want it, which is they need some benefit, which usually they don't have because the government's taken that away from them. So sorry to go off on that tangent, but I really like to drive that point home every time I hear socialism brought up, because one thing that I think is almost inflammatory that supports socialism is when somebody who doesn't support socialism says to somebody who does support it, you're wrong, and this is a terrible system. And to them, all they're really hearing is, you just don't want me to have what I want or what I need. And instead of proposing other ways for them to get it, which that gets more into political, but that's a point that I always like to make, so that anybody who's listening who is thinking about, you know, socialist type solutions to society's problems doesn't think that just because I don't like socialism, I don't know about yourself, but just because I don't like socialism does not mean that they are a bad person and that we're condemning them, just that there are other ways that we need to look at to you know, help them improve their lives and get what they want.
Support of young people for socialism is a key symptom of our school system's failure. It's easy, very easy to explain why that system fails. It provides perverse incentives. It incentivizes people to do bad things, including understating what their ability to produce is and to overstate their so-called needs. And it just doesn't work, because it doesn't solve the problems of figuring out how to produce things, where to produce them, and how to distribute them in a way that incentivizes high productivity. It provides bad incentives and does not signal where resources are in their highest and best use. So the fact that a lot of young people, and more young people than in any other demographic, support it is just a sign that our school system is totally broken. And there are plenty of signs like that,
right,
including what a lot of people don't understand is we've created a system that makes it very, very difficult to be a successful teacher. So regardless of how devoted to the craft some people are, and the vast majority of the teachers are devoted to it, they can't succeed because they're put in a position where it's very difficult to do what it is they're being asked to do. Children are sorted only by neighborhood and by age. It's just absurd. There are many children that are younger than others that are at the same level that they are academically in different subjects. And so if we put teachers in a situation where students are not sorted by any kind of ability, and by the way, I don't believe in tracking. Students differ in their ability by subject. So
right,
there's no such thing, or there's very little of, hey, somebody's really smart and somebody's not. They're really smart at some things and others.
Well, and
it's the same thing about expertise that people are touting in our response to the pandemic. Expertise is very narrow. So no one's an expert at everything. If you're an expert at a very narrow thing, that's pretty good. But that doesn't make you able to dictate policies to others. There are many experts that bear on any given decision.
Right. Yeah, you can be an expert in one field, but not an expert in the right individual's rights and have complete disregard for that. But it's interesting because this is something that I've always seen. And this is, I guess, another play on economics in a non-monetary fashion where, you know, a lot of it, and especially like I know this from my own development, I totally failed at school because they were teaching me things that I didn't want to learn and I was not even trying. But at the same time, I was really interested in computers and video games and science and math and all this other stuff. So much so that I was even learning math and science outside of school, not even realizing that I was learning, but just doing research because I was interested to know things. Turned out that's actually learning. And learning to program
engaged
and do this. And that's what I liked. I know other students liked playing football, and that, like, I have, as much as I don't play sports ball or pay attention to any of these things, I actually do have some respect for the fact that there's strategy involved in that. And some of these kids who are really interested in that, they learned from that. They learned, you know, the call it the art of war or whatever. They learned very intricate strategies about this, which, of course, these are strategies that later could be applied to business and other things in their lives. But what the school system always tries to do is one size fits all. Like you said, you know, distribute the education by zip code or city or you know, whatever, instead of saying, okay, well, if these kids are really good at math, let's put them in a math school. And if these kids are really good at English, put them, you know, I guess we should say English literature, put them in a school for that, creative writing and that sort of thing. And teach them, allow them to learn what they want to learn.
Exactly. You know, we don't want to put them there. We want them to put themselves there.
Right.
Because if we give them the power to put people there, they often make mistakes because no one knows the child any better than their parents do.
Right. And so, another interesting point you made was, which I really, this one is, I don't know, this could be a huge topic on its own, but talking about undervaluing your own, production, I think you said your own ability to produce, which is, I see this and I had this struggle, you know, when I was growing up that, I never had the self-esteem or the foresight that anything I could produce would be worth anything. I never had this vision that, you know, that like when they were showing me you go to high school and you graduate high school and you'll get this much money, you graduate college, you get this much, you get a master's, you get this much. I would look at those things and think like, oh, well, I mean, I don't really know much now, so what's the point of all this? And I see a lot of people who really think kind of the same. You know, they graduated high school and that was it, and so now they think that they have to be poor. They're always struggling to get through life. And I remember, you know, once I started entering the real world and getting jobs and that sort of thing, I struggled with that for a very long time. But at some point I was like, this isn't cool. I want to get out of this. And I kind of forced myself to learn, you know, what does it take to increase the income that I have? And it turned out the best way to increase your income is to increase your output, to increase what you're able to provide for other people. And so I started figuring out how could I do that. And then when I did that, it's like everything just started fitting together, and I started moving in this direction where I was able to increase my output, which in turn just automatically increased, you know, the return, what I was getting for that. And it wasn't anything magic. It's like all I had to do was just get this nonsense out of my head that was telling me, like, no, you can't do this. You're not Superman. You're not a celebrity. You're not any of these people. So therefore, you know, you can't do that. And I think that's it's absolutely terrible. And I know it hits a lot of people, and I see it, and I hear people say these things about how they're not, you know, oh yeah, well I'm going to work at a restaurant for the rest of my life. And so therefore we need to fix the rest of the economy because it doesn't serve people like me. And it's like, no, you don't have to work at a restaurant. Yes, the economy is all screwed up for a million other reasons, but you don't have to limit yourself to that job for your entire life.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you make a good point there indirectly, namely when you specialize in something, you suddenly become more productive and you can make a good living. But one thing we can't specialize in, or we shouldn't, to our peril, is our participation in the political process. That's how a failure to reform our school systems is going to bring us down. We're going to turn into Venezuela or Greece or North Korea because people won't know the difference often enough between bad policies and good. See, a lot of people ask, well, if we're so dumb, why are we so rich? Well, because most people can figure out a way to make a living without knowing a whole lot about a lot of things. They know a lot about one or two things, and they bump up their productivity, just like the example that you described, and suddenly they're doing right. Okay, and they're wondering, you know, why they thought they couldn't do okay from where they started out. Anybody can make a good living starting from you know, the person at the desk at McDonald's. You become the manager by working hard, and then suddenly you become the manager of the managers, and pretty soon you're doing really well, even though you thought you couldn't. I mean, the story you gave. But right. Unfortunately, that degree of specialization in how to do one job or one kind of job doesn't help you participate in society. And we all have to participate in society. And the government's gotten so big that we do specialize in how we participate when we participate at all. And in a lot of areas, we let other people determine our fate by not voting at all or by, worse of all, voting, but for something that's not in our self-interest because we don't understand it well enough. Right. We need to improve the effectiveness of our school systems to avoid enacting terrible policies that will turn us into a third world country.
So now sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we see that going on now. We risk going over a cliff in a short order here.
Yeah.
By enacting or by electing socialists.
Absolutely. So I want to hear you mentioned this earlier. What is the difference between school reform and, you said, school program reform?
School system reform.
School system reform.
Yeah, the school system is all the schools, public and private, and governance and funding determines how a school system will function as a whole, both the public parts and the private parts. And we cannot change schools individually very much or improve them a lot until we have improvement in the governance and funding policies. In particular, what the book calls non-discrimination is what we need to push. We cannot afford to discriminate between the people that think that the public school system works for them and those that believe that it is not, because it doesn't fit all. It cannot fit all. It's a politically correct system. Those for whom it is not working and clearly not working need to be able to take the money that supports them, have a level playing field, and go to a school that an entrepreneur has created and put out there as an alternative. Now, I'm not sure what the right mix is and how fast we'll get there, but some substantial share of the schools need to be created and owned and operated by entrepreneurs. We're not going to get rid of the public school system. If they went away, that'd be fine with me, but that's not going to happen. They're going to be a substantial part of what's out there for a long time. But they need to be on a level playing field with alternatives so that the people that believe that they're not getting engagement, like you described for yourself, you got engaged in the video games and all of that. You got excited about it. It made you learn. Well, the students and their families who are not engaged need to have an alternative so that they can be, because you're not going to learn anything. Economists call it a co-production process. You're not going to learn anything, you and the teacher together, unless you're both engaged in the process. You can't lecture to somebody or wag your finger at somebody and tell them things and make them learn it. They'll only learn it if they want to, which means they have to be engaged. They have to see a reason to want to learn it. And then that often that just doesn't happen in a one size attempt at a one size fits all system. It doesn't fit all. Look at the last two pieces of federal legislation. They basically both have the same title. Every Student Succeeds Act. That's the most recent one. And No Child Left Behind. Both of them tell you all you need to know. We are leaving children behind, and every student is not succeeding. So we need to provide an exit for them, which will be a catalytic in terms of changing the school system. We desperately need to change the menu of schooling options so that that menu is as diverse as our school children. Right now we have 90% of the children in schools that are aimed to be identical. One of the shortcomings of the political process is that the appearance of fairness is an absolute imperative. And brilliant Thomas Jefferson nailed it a long time ago when he said, the most unequal thing of all is the equal treatment of unequals. And that's the political process drives that. So we pretend everybody's the same so that we can treat them the same, and they're not.
Interesting. Yeah, and there's definitely, there's a ton of political rhetoric that's trying to create a division between people who have a lot of wealth and people who don't. I think it's all connected in this giant ball of knots, right? You can't just pull one of them out because they're all connected. But when you have people who have lower incomes, and then you have politicians saying, well, that's because you don't have access to the right schools, and you don't have access to the right schools because of all these wealthy people who are hoarding all the good teachers for their schools. Therefore, we need to implement more taxes, but taxes are actually what are going to hurt the poor and make them struggle harder to get by, make them unable to afford private schools that are better, take away their options on you know, how they're going to learn and what their future is going to look like. The small amount of money that they are earning is getting taken away. So they're not able to build savings and all this other stuff. And then this is all connected, right? Because when you're in what I like to call survival mode, you're basically, you know, you're worried about your survival. You're not, you can't build a solid foundation for your life that is going to get you success and prosperity and get you all the way up there when you're sitting, you know, right, just standing right on the ground, barely able to feed yourself. You're more concerned about the immediate needs and not able to look too far into your future. So I think like that pressure that's put on people is a tremendous detriment to them being able to move forward. And then the politicians, like I said, come along and take advantage of that and say, oh, well, it's not because we're taking everything from you. It's not because we're forcing you down to this low level of income and quality of life and everything else. No, it's because of these wealthy people that have managed to get out of that or had an advantage to start above that. So I think this is, I don't know. This is just it's a huge problem that's intertwined with so many other problems and so many different aspects of how the government operates.
It's a stunning thing, you know. If you look at a carefully drawn map with lots of zip codes or census tracts, and you shade them by income, you'll discover that we've created a system that causes the better off people. Wealthy is too strong a term. There aren't that many people that are rich enough to not care what a school costs them, and you know, private school tuition, they just, oh yeah, whatever. There's not enough people for that. But what does happen in our system is we've created a public school model is not conducive to producing very many good schools, but some are better than others. And because some are better than others, the people with the most money compete for the homes next to the better schools. Right? That's how you pay for schooling now. It's so free. No, it's not. It's free in terms of your taxes paid to put the people there. By the way, a lot of taxes and a lot of money. Even the worst schools have well over $10,000 per student per year, more than enough to succeed with a better business model. But what happens is the people with money compete to buy the better homes near the better schools, leaving the poorest people behind next to the worst schools. And often schools that are so bad that they're just utterly dysfunctional. You know, the incentives are all wrong in the public school system. And if you add to that the fact that everybody going there is poor and the teachers are the either the youngest or the worst that nobody else wants, you've created a recipe for the disaster that we have, which has been repeatedly called by the strongest of terms, nation at risk. I encourage your viewers to Google that. They'll come up with a 1983 report that had very strong language for how bad our school system is. And if you go to schoolsystemreformstudies.net, you'll find five additional studies that basically say the same thing from the same nonpartisan perspective. So we've had six nation at risk declarations, and yet we persist in wishing, hoping somehow that the current process will somehow suddenly start to succeed, where it's hope against all experience. At several levels, including the main level that I come at it from, namely central planning has never produced a good industry for doing anything. And yet all the school systems of the world are relying on that process to do the most important thing of all in terms of continuing their societies, namely the education of their children. And we're going to lose ours. That's what I'm afraid of if we keep cranking out young people that think socialism is cool.
Right. Yeah, I'm just reading some of the comments here. Karen is saying reading practices have destroyed three generations of our youth. Alexander is saying promote trade schools. Yeah, trade schools are it's another great example of specialization. But, you know, going back to your point about how specialization isn't necessarily the answer, it's like, and this is kind of like, so even outside of
specialization, specialization is the answer.
Well,
not for political participation, but for deciding how you're going to make a living. Schools need to be specialized in order to engage students in learning. We can't try to do everything for everybody.
Right. Well, I agree. But at the same time, if you specialize too much, you're kind of putting all your eggs in one basket, right? Because you have, you know, you could, for example, specialize in a type of, car repair, right?
Right. You can't,
gas car
you can't
repair.
Assign children.
Well,
yeah, you can't assign children to schools that are specialized. That's the reason that they're not specialized now, is because all the public schools, not charter schools, but all the other public schools, the vast majority, have attendance zones. If you live in that zone, you're assigned to a certain school. And you can't predict what kinds of student factors or issues are going to be within a zone around the school. So the school has to try to be everything to everybody. Now, that kind of specialization that you described could exist in a school of choice, because then only the children that their parents thought that they would be successful there would go there.
Right. Or this could be like a trade school type thing after high school. But my point is that, you know, if you specialize too much, if the automobile industry if you get specialized in that, so you can become an auto mechanic, and now all of a sudden we have cars that are so advanced they really don't require that much maintenance, that entire industry could go away. And
sure.
I know there's like so one, if you're extremely specialized and you expect to live the rest of your life on that, that's potentially dangerous. I think that's where college goes, right? Because college teaches you, become, my dad was an engineer where he worked in aerospace, and he had to manually calculate how like wind would travel over the wing of an aircraft. And it's like, you have computers for that now. You have accountants who are taught how to add up all these numbers from like different accounts and everything. And now you have computers for managing a lot of that. So while there are still professional accountants, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, how to use the computers that do this now, there's still this evolution that, you know, certain trades are going to come and go. I think we have
with certain kinds of schools. Yeah, they would come and go too. That's why we need a school system that where there's a strong role, a level playing field for schools created by entrepreneurs, because some of those will come in to replace the ones that are becoming obsolete. See, on the public side of the school system, we have lots of things going on for centuries. Yeah, maybe that's a little strong, but 150 years that have been going, that's been obsolete for 100 years, but they persist because they can force payment through taxes. See, the schools that are run by entrepreneurs, they can't, they have to be choice worthy.
Well, and that's what we need. I think there's also, and it might have to do with the fantasy of socialism that, that the politicians push, but there's this fantasy of education that once you graduate, you know everything you know, and you'll have a wonderful life, and you don't need to continue to learn. And I think that's equally as bad, because like even in my profession, which is specialized, I have to continue to learn. Otherwise, like, you know, the new tools and the new everything's coming out, and if I don't know how to use those, then I become worthless. That's, and it could be an entire industry that goes away, like I said about auto mechanics. So I think there's like this fantasy of like, education is great, don't get me wrong, but there's a fantasy about how great it is that I think is overemphasized. Especially when you talk about like, let's say, trade schools or job training, where, you know, you, if you just want to focus on learning to be a productive member of society, I hate that term, but if that's what you like, if you skip school and go straight to employment training and you have an internship, you will learn and you will become more productive more quickly than if you're in school. But of course, there are other things in school, maybe not in public school, that you can learn that are very interesting, that are just going to help make your life better. And actually, I would say most of these things probably just aren't taught in public schools at all.
Well, they're taught to an audience that's so diverse that it's very hard to engage them all. Hence the no child left behind.
Right.
Every student succeeds. The diversity within a classroom is too large for a typical teacher to do differentiated instruction enough to reach them all. So we have a lot of children left behind at very high cost. We're spending an awful lot of money on a system that, when it performs at its peak, is probably reaching about 50 to 60% of the children in a given classroom. That's at its peak. When it fails for all the reasons that central planning does, the poor information, the bad incentives, then we have some of our inner city schools that are just a total disaster zone that don't serve anybody.
Right. So what do you have a recommendation for people who are, you know, maybe sick of like maybe they have kids and they're sick of the public school system. They don't want their kids to go there, especially. I mean, it's extremely unpopular right now, especially because of the COVID-19 stuff that's going on and reopening the schools and all the regulations they want to go through. Not telling parents you're not allowed to monitor your kids and what they're, you know, and their Zoom conferences, which is kind of scary on its face. But apparently a lot of parents are really upset with this whole system now. And they're looking for alternatives, but of course there's a million excuses of, you know, why they don't want to do systems.
See, that's the thing. We need a focused conversation on school system reform because we need more and better alternatives. So I'm offering sort of an intermediate term take on how to move forward. Namely, we need to change the funding and governance rules. The fact that we fund only public school students out of tax dollars and not all students, for example. We need to change the funding and governance rules so that what the choices are will change. Now, in answer to your question, what does a frustrated parent do now? Well, the choice is pretty much between dig deep and find money to pay twice. I mean, you keep paying your taxes for a system you don't want to use, and then use. And hopefully, you can find a charter school that's not full that you can get into. That's still free. But the only alternative when that's not available is to assert your rights. It's amazing how many rights, unlimited resources that you have under the existing law. The problem is it's a five alarm battle to assert your rights in a timely manner to help your child. And it takes you having an advocate or a lawyer in order to move forward in a reasonable way in the current system. But that's the only option right now.
Well, what kind of
hopefully the other option, it can be developed within a year or two, in states that adopt what I call non-discrimination, namely with the public dollars collected for schooling. We're going to treat all children the same, whether they attend a public school or an alternative to it.
When you talk about asserting rights, what kind of rights are you talking about?
Well, for example, a child for whom mainstream schooling isn't working has a right to an individualized education plan, an IEP. And through a process of consulting with experts, which frankly I feel is horrific because it's all adversarial, but that's the only game in town right now. They either find an alternative to your assigned school, hopefully a charter school, and many of the better ones are full, you get put on a waiting list, or assert your rights and get an individualized education plan that allow you services other than what mainstream children get. And
I see.
That
so
can work for parents that are really wise to how the system works and which lawyers to hire and who to scream at and who to complain
And that could cost more than just going to a private school, it sounds like. But so this would be...
Oh, I don't know how much it costs. I guess the helpers, the lawyers, and the advocates aren't free.
Right.
But it probably doesn't cost as much as a private school tuition for each of your children. You know, if you're getting a six-figure income like I used to have as a professor, that doesn't suddenly make a $5,000 to $10,000 per child per year tuition irrelevant. That's still 1/6 to 1/3 of your take-home pay.
Especially after taxes.
The number of people that can just... the take-home and after. The number of people for whom a private school tuition is irrelevant or is like, okay, fine, we'll go to private schools is very, very small. And that's why the private school system, or the private sector of our existing school system is very, very small. That's what we have to change. We need to level the playing field so that somebody that puts out a private school, that the children that go there get the same level of public funding support as the children that go elsewhere. I think we need to use the term non-discrimination to propose that because it makes use of the fact that the appearance of fairness is paramount in a political process. We will not tolerate unfair treatment of children for whom the public school system is not a good functioning alternative. And forgive me for promoting my book, but school system reform is my book. And that's I think the basis of a focused conversation. That's what we need. On how to realize the school system that we can realize in a short amount of time. The how is the critical thing. We're stuck on weather, not rain and snow, not that kind of weather. W-H-E-T-H-E-R.
Right.
We are stuck in America on whether to have transformational school system. We need to get past that. We need to get to how to do it. And as many of your messages that you told me about, everybody has their own idea, with this curriculum, that curriculum, train teachers better, do this, do that. As long as we all have 1,000 different ways that we think the school systems are going to improve, we're not going to move anywhere. By the way, a lot of those things that you mentioned, or I guess you only mentioned about 2 or 3 of them, those are all central planning optimization approaches, which means they're not going to go anywhere. I mean, they may make some small difference in a school that adopts them, but anything that doesn't work through allowing entrepreneurs to create schools of choice is only going to be a little ripple effect for a little while. That's what's relying on central planning teaches us. If we're operating through changing directly how schools decide what to teach, how to teach it, and where to teach it, no, we need to operate indirectly, namely empowering entrepreneurs to provide alternatives to the way the politically correct system we have now does that.
Right. I want to go back to your book for a second and give you an opportunity just to tell everyone who's interested where they can go to get that.
Yeah, you can just Google school system reform at either Barnes & Noble or Amazon, and my book will come up. It's a really nice looking cover and has great reviews. So that'll get you $10, will get you the electronic copy, or $20 for the paperback. So it's probably not even as expensive as a meal out, and it'll change your outlook totally on what we need to do, or at least that's the aim of it, to change your outlook totally on what needs to be done for all the lesser things that you think need to be done to ever happen. Trade schools, teaching reading differently. None of that's going to happen to any great extent, and probably shouldn't happen to any extent for everyone. It should happen on a specialized basis so the students that could benefit from a different way of teaching reading will have access to it, or the ones that want to go to a trade school rather than getting college prep can have that as an option. There is no magic silver bullet. That right. Nothing works for everybody, and there isn't anything, and everyone can't benefit from any given thing. We need diverse schooling options within our school system in order to save our country, frankly.
Right. Yeah, and I can totally see, I mean, a lot of people will, you know, I don't know, I guess you could talk about you're on Netflix and you start watching a show, and this show's not for me, and you switch to a different show. You're not forced to finish that show.
Right.
New Year's comes around and you make your resolution to go to the gym or lose weight. And so you go to the gym and it doesn't work out for you. So you try changing your diet and it doesn't work out. So you try something else. And it's really with school, we don't really have that option. We should be able to say, okay, well, we tried this thing and it didn't work. Let's try something else. And when you find something that your kids really enjoy and is working for them and they're able to learn, that's really what we need to stick with. We shouldn't just, like, you know, throw your kids to the wolves and see how they do. It's terrible. And yeah, that's the central planning that you're talking about.
If you're sending your kid to the assigned school and he or she is doing great, great. I mean, awesome, great. It probably, when it's a good school, one of the better schools in the system, probably works pretty well at a too high a cost, but it usually works pretty well for about half the kids sent there. So that's part of the politics of why we're struggling to change it. About half to 60% of the people are happy with the schooling that their child is getting, and they don't want to take any chances on changing. And I'm asking them to take a chance on that school, good school, surviving and entrepreneurs creating alternatives for the children that are not thriving in the curriculum in the circumstances that your child is thriving in.
Right. Now, you mentioned this number. So a private school is about 10,000 per year for a student.
Oh, it varies. You go to a parochial school and you can get $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 per child per year. But even that multiplied by two or three children takes an awfully large bite out of the vast right. majority of income.
But what does, So first I want to know, what does a public school, because I've heard public schools spend something like $30,000 per student.
No, that's on the high end. There are schools like that that do that. The national average is for the whole system, including the DOE and all the state bureaucracies. If you divide all the money spent on K-12 by the number of children in public schools, you get about $13,000 a year.
Okay.
So if you multiply that by, say, 20 to figure out how much money stands behind a classroom, you're going to come up with $260,000, which is way more than the teacher is getting. And so where does the rest of that money go? It goes to those bureaucracies and to lots of aides and lots of things. And
right.
So that's what I meant by, even if your child is doing well and the schooling that he or she is getting is pretty good, it probably costs way more than it could under a more competitive and more of a dynamic, flexible system. But okay, we can, you know, that terrible schooling at a lower price is not what we're after. What we're after is better schooling. Even if we have to keep the price the same for the time being, non-discrimination. Let's change one thing at a time so we make sure we do it. And that one thing is that the same amount of money, public money, follows a child wherever he and she thinks through their parents would work best for them. And a key aspect that a lot of people don't consider or think is important for the price system to do its magic. And I mean, literally, it's almost magic. You have to allow the families to top off that government funding, either whether the funding comes through a voucher, tuition voucher, most people have heard of those, or an education savings account, or through tax credits, whatever pathway that public money follows your child to an alternative to the public school system. You have to be at liberty to top that dollar amount off. So that, for example, let's say you have a tuition voucher worth $8,000 a year, and you want to send your daughter to a school that charges $9,000 a year. Well, $8,000 plus $1,000 from you, that's the top off. A lot of people object to that. It's a sop to the rich, et cetera. We don't have time to get into all of the reasons. But if you don't allow the top off, for one thing, two things happen. A lot of schools go away because they can't get by on just the government amount of money. And that's one of the old sayings in economics that at least puts a grin on a few people's faces. If you limit prices, if you set them, it's magic. You make things disappear. And so one bad thing happens. Things, a lot of schools go away that can't get by on the government set amount. And the other bad thing that happens is that you no longer have price control. So you no longer have that dynamic process of prices rising and falling, first to limit the usage of something to the amount that's available, and through that price to signal whether more should be provided or less. See, that's the magic, the self-delivering magic of the price system. In the process of making supply equal demand, it signals to entrepreneur whether it's worth providing more of something or less of something.
Right.
We can teach that in a K-12 system. It takes more than a couple minutes on a podcast to totally nail that down. We right. need to do things like that so that people don't think socialism is cool. The price system is the only way to regulate the provision of things in a productive manner, namely to make supply equal demand in the short run, and in the long run, to make sure that the resources flow to where people value them the most.
Right. Now, what's interesting, because in my position is that, of course, you look at the money that you're spending, right, in property tax. A lot of people they're probably going to be paying between $5,000 and $10,000 a year in property tax. In Texas, they have the property tax, and then they have the school tax on top of that, which is part of the property tax right. bill. And that's almost enough money. So it's like, so really, you know, especially with like a voucher system, although I think the voucher system is a little bit different, but basically all they're saying is you put all this money into this program and you don't like the school that it went to pay for. So take your money out and take it elsewhere so that you can have the school that you choose. Which I don't see why that just isn't the way we do it now. Like, there must be somebody who is opposing this, and I don't know why they would, unless of course it's some corrupt government bureaucrat, but, it's like that just seems to be obvious sense. You paid for something and you don't want it. Give me my money back and let me take it elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the people that work in the public school system and those who send their children there that think that it's working for their children don't want to rock the boat. Okay? So they're saying, yeah, the money belongs to us, not to your children. It belongs to us. So you can leave if you want to, but you got to leave your money behind. But so we're both in Texas, so we can discuss that system a little bit. I think I pay like $8,000 or $9,000 to the local school district every year through my property taxes. And I know from looking at the data that the local money for most school districts, it varies, as you know, because of our Robin Hood plan, that the schools that have more local property wealth get to less state taxes. But on a statewide average, about half the money that school districts get is from the state. So that means that over the last many years, I've been sending about $17,000 a year to the state and for nothing.
So that's basically collected even through your other taxes, right? Your gas tax, your sales yeah. tax, and all these other things that are going to the state and then making their way back to the school.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, in Texas, there's no income tax. So right. franchise tax, which is sort of an income tax on corporations, and the sales tax is the big tax in Texas. And,
so
that delivers a lot of money to school systems.
This is
everything you buy
in
a business. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is an interesting one, too, because I remember a few years ago, there was a school that I drove by in San Antonio that had like this huge banner on it. And it was like, I don't remember exactly what it said, but it was like, keep your kids in public school or something like that. And it's like, when I saw that, it was just like, so you're telling me your schools are so bad you can't give it away for free. People would rather pay, even though they've already paid for yours, they would rather pay double to go somewhere else. And you have to advertise to like remind people how free it is to go to your schools. It's absolute nonsense. And like, you know,
stunning.
Like they probably had some people who were sitting around. You know, how can we make our student retention rate higher? Oh, let's advertise and do marketing for the school. But they're not sitting around saying, how can we make our schools better? Because they get paid either way, right?
Well, there's some, I mean, yes and no. I mean, yeah, they get paid either way, but they are trying to make their schools better. But the problem is they can't make them better for everybody assigned to them. Nothing curriculum-wise, textbook-wise, works for everyone. It never has and it never will. So if you force all the children to go to the same school because they have to pay twice to go elsewhere, you will leave a lot of children behind. Not every student will succeed. Many will be unengaged in curriculum and teaching that is working brilliantly for the child sitting right next to them. Okay? That's what we need, school choice. So something that works for some people can continue, while the children for whom it is not working can take their money and go elsewhere to some place where it does. So where someone like you can learn about video games and the math underlying them so that they're motivated to learn the math rather than being taught sort of a one-size-fits-all math, all math for all people at the same time, which doesn't teach anything that's of any interest to many children, sometimes no one.
Right. Yeah, that's actually an interesting point too, because I know that you talk about math. I used to learn some sorts of math, and I was like, this is silly. What am I ever going to use this for in my life? But then once I found something that I enjoyed, then it wasn't like, oh, what am I going to use this for? It was, how do I do this? How do I make this work? How do I get involved in this? And it's kind of like, instead of pushing information on people, it's inspiring them to want that information. But that goes back to your point that
exactly.
Everyone's going to be a little bit different, in how they learn and what they learn, but yeah,
exactly, there's a lot of diversity there.
Yeah, but I think ultimately, I think that speaks to the economic side of that. It's the consumer will consume what they want to consume, not what you force them to consume. And I think that's the getting the students motivated to learn the things that they want to learn, instead of just forcing that curriculum on them.
Well, it's a somewhat complicated process, because some entrepreneur out there has to figure out that there's an unfilled niche. And then he or she has to put it out there and cross their fingers and their toes and their eyebrows and everything else that'll cross to hope that enough people within the reasonably close to an actual brick and mortar school will find their school and enroll in it. That's a tough process, but that's the only one that's ever been made to work for anything. Families and their children will consume what they want to consume if they can find it. A lot right now cannot find something. Well, they don't even know what it is that they want to consume because they've never seen it to be able to buy it. But there's an entrepreneur out there, many of whom are current teachers, that say, you know, a lot of my kids would have benefited from X, Y, and Z. I'm going to go out and create a chain of schools that do X, Y, and Z. Suppose they're successful and the tuition that they charge suddenly makes them rich. Well, that means that they'll be copied by others. Bingo, the system worked. Somebody had a good idea. It made them rich. They were copied. It drove the price down to barely enough to cover the cost of it. So we get justice both for the kids and the entrepreneur who stuck his or her neck out in hoping that something would attract enough business, and it attracted more than enough, so they're able to sell for more than it actually cost to do it, but not for long, because we allow people to copy things. So there's two kinds of entrepreneurs, and we need them both. The ones that set out with new ideas and those that copy the new ideas once they're allowed to. They're given things like patents and such.
Right. So I we're coming towards the end of the show, and I want to wrap this up, but something you just said kind of put a thought in my head. So I want to talk about this for a minute. If you've got the time.
Us ex-professors, and we live for putting thoughts in people's heads.
So it's a great proposition that somebody will come up with an idea, they'll implement it, they'll see if it works. If it does, they'll make money and someone's going to copy them. The question always is, if that's the socialist coming to the libertarian saying, well, if that would work, then why aren't they already doing that now? Now, of course, that some people are doing that, but
unlevel playing field is the short answer.
Right. And so you touched on a couple of these points, but there's legality, right? Can you just take your kids out and put them in any school? Not usually. There's usually rules around what's qualified as a school, what's qualified as curriculum.
If you don't, not too bad in Texas. Yeah, not too bad. No,
but it's there's like some degree of that that's there. I think yeah, definitely not in Texas. Texas is, but some of these states, like I think New York and, you know, California, where they have like these, you know, we're going to arrest the parents because their kids haven't been showing up for school, that kind of nonsense. And then you have, like you were talking about, the price competition, where people have like, well, how can you compete with free when the other schools
are free?
Well,
that's what I mean by the unlevel playing field. Exactly. Right. This entrepreneurial process is blunted by the fact that you're asking people to pay for something that's with a poor substitute, admittedly, but is still available for free, and you're asking them to pay twice. And so they may not either be willing to pay for something that's available for free, pay money for that, or they may be unable to, or both, typically both. So you have a tiny private sector, mostly subsidized by churches, as the result of our school funding and governance rules. That's what we mean by a school system. The system is the result of the rules that apply to the whole system, not just the public school system. And so we have the private sector we have now because of those rules. Those are the rules we need to change so that all the things that people imagine in your comments would work to make schools more successful can be available in enough schools in just the right amount through the price system to meet the demands of the children for whom it would be the best possible alternative.
Awesome. All right. Well, that's our show for today, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in. Definitely check out John Merrifield. Check out his book on, I think you said, Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Is that right?
Right. School system reform at Barnes & Noble or Amazon.
School system reform. All right, guys, it's been awesome. Like I said before, please support this show. Head on over to taxationistheft.cards, pick up some awesome swag. And of course, make sure to share this with your friends if you like the episode. Make sure you subscribe so you can get all of the future episodes that we're coming up with. We got some really great content that's going to be coming out in the next couple of weeks for you. You definitely don't want to miss it. And until I see you next time, taxation is theft. I'll see you around, guys.